News.
New York City.
FAQ NYC podcast getting more and more interesting by the minute.
FAQ.
It's FAQ NYC, the New Yorkers podcast from the newsroom by and for New Yorkers, the city. I'm Katie Honan, here with Dr. Christina Greer and Harry Siegel. Hi, guys.
Hi.
In a bit, Politico New York health reporter Maya Kaufman will join to discuss her reporting on what might be the end of life for the Beth Israel Medical Complex in Lower Manhattan. What's happening with Mount Sinai, which owns Beth Israel, in its now public contract fight with an insurance provider that's changing the coverage of many New Yorkers now scrambling to find new providers, and more, including the governor's plan to close the downstate medical complex in Brooklyn. But first, Harry's going to jump right in with just a couple pieces of news from another jam-packed week in New York City.
Hey, Gov Kathy Hochul has ordered the state to review the way it hands out legal cannabis licenses after she realized what anyone covering this or reading it or just walking around New York has known for a while, the process is a, quote, disaster. The story that's dominated the front pages, though, the Brooklyn DA won't charge the 32-year-old man who shot another strap hanger on a Manhattan-bound A-train last week. Footage from the chaotic train shows a verbal fight with another passenger berating this guy, and things then escalate. They square off. Other passengers are cowering on one end of the train. A woman appears as the guy who initiates this is beating on the other guy and starts stabbing the bigger guy repeatedly in the back. The bigger guy goes back to his jacket, pulls out a gun. The footage turns away. Somehow the guy who was getting wailed on ends up with the gun and shoots the man who had initiated the conflict in what the district attorney says appears to be self-defense, the Brooklyn district attorney. The shooting and the violent fight came days after Kathy Hochul sent in the National Guard to check bags in the subway system, a move criticized by a lot of people as a waste of resources and money that could be better spent on other things to make people feel safe on the rails. Chrissy, we talked a lot about this last week, but here we are again. What's going on? Are there any signs that the governor and the mayor have a handle on the underground and New Yorkers' fears about it, which both of them keep describing in psychological terms as the crime numbers remain low compared to historical norms, elevated compared to before the pandemic, and amid what seems like an endless series of nightmare scenarios that end up capturing national attention?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for so many millions of New Yorkers, present company included, you take the subway because it is the lifeline of the city. This goes back to what we have consistently talked about, perception versus reality. The numbers are the numbers, and in a lot of ways, the city is safer. I did like your piece from this weekend where you sort of laid things out, which is like, you know, some numbers, we're kind of judging them incorrectly, right? Because it's like the COVID numbers don't really count when nobody was on the subway. So that is, I think, a fair analysis. But here's the thing. We've got people back on the subways. We have a lot of mentally challenged folks back on the subways as well. I think, you know, am I one of these banned police from everything? No. Do we need police kind of walking around and intimidating people? Absolutely not. I don't understand Kathy Hochul's desire to put, as Katie and I called it last week, performance theater of the National Guard on these platforms with these massive guns, where clearly you're not going to catch guns that way. That's just not the way it works. So are we about to start having like airport security at the subway station? I mean, why? I think my frustration is our leaders, Kathy Hochul specifically and Eric Adams to a certain extent, insist on this over-policing concept instead of putting money into resources to assist mentally challenged folks, to put it in education, to put it in all these early things, the things that Eric Adams campaigned on, right? Let's get the people at the top of the waterfall before they fall in the waterfall. And instead, you keep wanting to just flood the bottom of the waterfall with police. How about we go back to campaign rhetoric today and start thinking of the ways that you promised us in 2021, when I still didn't vote for you, but that's okay. You made that promise and it was actually quite exciting to enough people to think about it. Kathy Hochul, who I hear it now lives in the city. So, okay. So I know she's not taking the subway. And I think that's part of the issue of so many of our leaders don't take the subway on a regular basis. But having 750 or 1,000 National Guard folks with these massive guns walking around performatively in their khakis and camouflage isn't helping. So if things are popping off on the subway, we don't have enough police sort of patrolling the subway. Now, police officers without massive guns actually walking the subway, I don't think it's a terrible idea. Seeing police huddled around where we swipe the turnstile playing Candy Crush, I have a major problem with that. If I see one more police officer on their phone ignoring what is happening around them, I've literally seen people, you know, getting into sort of tense situations. Cops are like 20 feet away, but they're talking. Like, it's almost like they're just strap hangers too, on the clock, getting paid to not work. And by no means am I saying all police officers don't work. I don't want to see those emails or texts. I'm saying when I'm on the subway, I don't see police officers. When I'm swiping my card at the turnstile, yes, I'm still 1,000 years old because I don't like pulling out my phone. I see way too many cops huddled. And when I was a camp counselor, camp counselors can appreciate this vignette, we had a thing where it's like no clusters. There should never be more than two camp counselors together at any point in time. Because if it's four or five of us together in a cluster, then that means a whole bunch of kids are unsupervised. So whenever I would see two camp counselors, more than two camp counselors together, I'm like, hey, break it up. Because somebody needs to go watch the store. We've got way too many clusters of cops who like aren't on the subway. They're just kicking it on the platform. So if I felt like it wasn't a waste of money and time and resources and a full performance for whom, I don't know, maybe the Republicans in Long Island, then maybe I'd be a little bit more open to these strategies. But it doesn't seem like a strategy. It just seems like let's throw some big gun men on the situation and say that we're doing something.
I just want to point out, I know we said this last week, they don't have the big guns. I mean, Kathy Hochul pulled back the big guns. They don't have military assault style rifles. So
they do. They just don't at the bag checks.
Yeah, because I've seen them. Yeah, I'm like, they've got big ass guns. The back,
just for that, yeah.
Like, no, if they're searching through someone's bag, they don't have the massive gun, but there's still someone next to them with a massive gun. A gun is a gun. Like, I don't like seeing massive.
I haven't seen them. Where have you seen them? I haven't.
Well, I ride like the 4, 5, 6, the 1, 2, 3, the A.
Me too. I haven't seen him at Grand Central or Penn. I mean, I see some that predated this new initiative. Like, you know, they just kind of bopping around, but I haven't seen any of the bag checks.
I've seen them a lot. I haven't seen the bag checks. I've seen the guys just walking around at Penn Station a lot. But here's the thing. It's like, don't talk about it, be about it, right? So like, you've got this big old gun. So what are you going to do with it if you see something going down? Are you going to use the gun? Like, what is the training? So these are people who are now in an urban environment with a loaded gun, I'm presuming they're not coming to work with bullets in their pockets. So, like, if you see something, what are you going to do with the gun? Like, is it just a deterrent, or are you going to use it on the population in New York City? I just don't know, like, where's that conversation? Let's play this scenario out to the hilt. You see someone who's mentally challenged. You see that he or she is harassing New Yorkers, and they're getting out of control. They're possibly getting violent. Maybe they pull out a knife or a gun. Do you then use your massive gun on them? Do you have the accuracy in a subway platform of God knows how many people? Like, I mean, walk me through your thought process, Kathy Hochul.
So she's taken pains not to explain this, which is probably one of the more politically resonant parts of this plan, which is definitely aimed at the large majority of New Yorkers who continue to say over the last several years that they feel less safe than they did a year ago. So they keep talking about the psychology of this plan. The reason you have those soldiers who precede this new plan in places like Grand Central is because of fears of a Mumbai-like attack, when you actually need some sort of militarized response. It's beyond what police can handle. The Mumbai attack in 2008, you know, involved multiple shooters throughout the city with heavy weaponry, you know, who overwhelmed like police officers with regular guns and murdered people all around the city. You know, you have polling showing, which I've written about, that like a scarily high percentage of New Yorkers, something like 70%, like really fear some sort of mass murderous event targeting a particular group in the city. So Hochul, instead of bringing any of that up when she announced this plan, said, this is so you feel safe on the train, that like there aren't people, regular New Yorkers, with guns and knives. She kept referring, after the initial backlash, not to guardsmen or guardspeople at all. She said, these are our moms and dads, our brothers and sisters, our neighbors. So she's entirely failed to explain any of that. Adams, for his part, bizarrely, after this really scary Hoyt Skimmerhorn shooting, which was the 9th shooting so far in the train system this year, compared to 1 in the same stretch last year. You know, he said, well, clearly, this is why we need a law that makes it easier to force severely mentally ill people to get evaluations from Albany. There's no sign that I've seen. He says it's clear in the video that this guy was severely mentally ill. He did have a violent criminal record. His ex-wife said that he was a really aggressive drunk. It just troubles me that the people who keep talking about soothing New Yorkers' fears seem really incapable of coming up with policies that actually relate to those fears. There seems to be like some split between what these folks are talking about and what New Yorkers are concerned about that seems extremely weird. And the last thing I'll say here is the NYPD, while Adams is talking about this is why we need help from Albany to take these crazy people off of our streets, you know, the transit chief was declaring the morning of the shooting, it was printed, you cannot arrest your way out of this problem. Severely mentally ill people, mental health, a person in the throes of an episode is an ongoing problem. And obviously, our tools cannot address the persistent issue of mental illness. We are equipped to stop an immediate threat in one moment at a time, disrupt a single act, which is a long way of saying none of this is our problem at all, which is, forgive me, crazy. And this is not, we need the police to be bothering the hell out of everyone. But when, you know, there's a guy who lives in our subway station where the city is, who just stays inside the station surrounded by a pool of half-smoked cigarettes with his pants down half the time. This guy needs help. He is trapped in his own world. I would guess, and I've tried to talk with him unsuccessfully, he has no idea he needs help, which is something that happens with a lot of schizophrenic people. And police officers are in that station sometimes. He's there, they're just ignoring him. And so Hochul has this smaller part of the program, which obviously got missed with the crazy guard announcement, called Scout, that's pairing clinicians, not with the NYPD cops, because they want nothing to do with this, but with MTA cops, who seem much more culturally open to doing so, where the clinician is in the lead, and there's 2 or 3 cops with them. And they're engaging with people not to build like a long-term, multiple-year rapport, but to say, you seem, you know, your feet are swollen, you're not wearing shoes, you have an open wound, you know, we need to evaluate you to see if you need help. And Adams, in taking what seems to be, quote-unquote, ordinary antisocial violence and trying to throw that into this other construction, it's bizarre. Like, the cops are nothing to do with this. He's saying that's the real issue. It just seems like a lot of alibiing and not taking account of what New Yorkers are looking for. And Chrissy, this is not 1989, no doubt, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I take the trains all the time. The trains are pretty nice. There's stuff I have to navigate like everyone else.
Right.
But, you know, we don't have the ridership we did before the pandemic. Cuomo just came out with the piece in the Post, of course, saying, oh, by the way, the congestion pricing thing I did, never mind about that.
Go away.
Listen, these Cuomo brothers are a menace to society. Both of
Cuomo,
them.
Cuomo, go away.
Both. Which one? Both. Put them both in the bucket. You've got Chris, who's hanging out with all the right-wing nut jobs these days. You've got Andrew, who just, I mean, he's like a bad penny. He's like teetering on Andrew Yang style right now. Just go away. No one is checking for you. We don't want nobody who nobody sent. Like, your time is done.
If you're going to run, run. But like, whatever. Yeah, but it's just,
but guess
sorry,
what?
Harry.
Like, let it go. Like, coulda, shoulda, woulda. It didn't happen. And guess what? It's not going to happen. There is, in your small section of your world, there are people who are clamoring for your great return. Climb the city on the top of the hill. But at some point in time, think about all the things your father must have taught you, especially after his big loss after his third term. It is time to pack up your marbles and go home. Think about all the people you possibly mentored. Think about some of the people you should have mentored. And maybe they could carry on your legacy.
Yeah.
But it's a wrap, B. Like, it's over. And I'm
be like so, a cicada. Like, go underground for 17 years.
Please. But, you know, or go with your brother and start hanging out with Tucker Carlson and Bill O'Reilly, because right. That's clearly what you guys like to do now that you're all hurt that, you know, these women have taken over. I mean, what a disappointment. You know, not like my expectations were sky high, but geez Louise, this is just.
You said that like you were
it
his,
is
you
a
know,
bridge too far.
You said a disappointment like you were Andrew Cuomo's, you know, college professor. Did he take your class?
No, he didn't. But, you know, the thing is, I think I read a lot of old speeches, you know, as one does, right? I listen to presidential tapes from the White House, which I find terribly interesting.
We all have weird hobbies.
We all have very weird hobbies. And mine, the list is long. But I like to read old speeches. And some of his dad's old speeches are just of a man who's really thoughtful and thinks about democracy and this city and this state. And I really think that he loved this city and this state and this country. And I think that there's like, there's an immigration narrative that he always weaves through. And this is also a time where like Italians were really, really, you know, sort of overtly denigrated. And he fought a lot of that. You know, this is kind of like, you know, you'll never have the leader with the vowel of the last name. I mean, things like that. And I just, it's like the classic story of like the father works really hard and then the two sons kind of come in on like the tales of daddy's hard work. And, you know, they are born on third and think that they hit a triple. It's like, you didn't. Your dad did a lot of things, but I'm not sure what you did.
Ooh. So when Adams and Hochul say psychology, what you should hear is public polling. They want to change public polling they think is not in line with the actual circumstances in terms of public safety and especially on the trains. What Andrew Cuomo is drumbeating right now is a city in crisis narrative where without his strong hand on top, things are going to hell. And they're aiming to correct that and shift these polls and to keep Cuomo sidelined as such. Obviously, stay tuned. We're going to see where all of this goes. But joining us right now is Maya Kaufman of Politico. Hello.
Hello.
Maya Kaufman is a reporter covering health in New York City for Politico. After a previous stint covering the industry for Cranes and covering Queens before that for Patch, she's written multiple investigations and exclusives about the city's hospitals, including a recent piece on the apparently imminent closure of Mount Sinai Beth Israel in Manhattan that found the medical center is increasingly transferring seriously ill patients to other hospitals because they no longer offer the procedures they need to survive. This includes a patient with a ruptured appendix who had sepsis and had to wait more than an hour for an ambulance to take them elsewhere. Maya, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm just going to start with this overarching, really frightening question. What is the state of emergency care at hospitals in New York City today?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And thank you for having me. So the situation that we see right now in New York City is increasingly long wait times. A lot of hospitals are seeing a handful of patients waiting for beds in the emergency room who have been deemed needing hospitalization, but are still waiting for that bed to open up. And so when we're thinking about the state of hospital care in New York City, we're in a situation where we're facing the imminent closure, most likely, of Mount Sinai Beth Israel in Manhattan. And that's something that especially health advocates and people who live in the area fear can further pressure the situation that already is quite constrained at other hospitals in New York City.
And yeah, I mean, since you brought it up, and we'll continue with this on Mount Sinai Beth Israel, what is happening there? And I will say, I note, it's not uncommon as reporters, but I know their response to your inquiries, there was it like a third-party group? We can talk later, I think, of how the health department was trying to keep you from doing stories as well. I mean, what's been the hospital, and by the hospital, I mean the boss's response to this, but I guess we'll go first with what is happening there and what's been the official line from them on what they say is not happening.
Right. So to take a step back, the hospital, Beth Israel, it's owned by Mount Sinai Health System, which operates a number of hospitals in the city. And in the fall, they said that they were going to permanently close Beth Israel this coming July because they We're seeing mounting operating losses that were threatening the financial sustainability of the entire system. So all of those other hospitals mm-hmm. and clinics and doctors' offices that are part of the Mount Sinai system. And so what is happening now is Mount Sinai basically laid out a plan to the health department, which technically has to approve of any hospital closure. You need that regulatory approval. And Mount Sinai, its plan to the state, basically laid out a timeline of gradual closures. They can't just, you know, one day they're totally open and then one day they're totally closed. There's kind of a phase down mm-hmm. of operations. So they laid out this timeline of saying, you know, we're going to transfer out this specialty to this other hospital. We're going to close this unit and laid it out to the state health department. But the problem with that is that the state health department found at the end of the year that Mount Sinai was doing closures of beds and services without that approval. Remember, the mm-hmm. state health department is supposed to approve all of these mm-hmm. things. And so the line from Mount Sinai is that they've been in communication with the state health department about these changes. They laid out their timeline of phasing down operations. And also that staff are leaving. They can't keep operating certain things because there's people resigning. They can't safely provide certain services. There's certain requirements for various services about who you need to have on staff and how quickly they need to be able to get there and that kind of thing. And so that's been one of the arguments that we hear from Sinai on why they can't be providing certain things. But one of the patterns that I notice is that even for pretty basic emergency care for people who are still coming into their emergency room, which remains open and is basically one of the last parts of the hospital that is supposed to remain open until the end, those folks are getting transferred elsewhere because Mount Sinai is not making pretty basic things like appendectomies available for those patients. And so I spoke to a number of people who are still on the front lines, who are still working day in, day out at Beth Israel, who told me they keep transferring patients who come in for these emergency conditions, even though theoretically it's unclear if they have that regulatory approval to not be providing those things anymore. It's a little bit fuzzy, and we don't have a lot of clarity from either the state health department or Mount Sinai because there's ongoing investigations, there's an ongoing lawsuit over the closure, and so all of that has kind of muddled the situation of what we know publicly.
So, Maya, I have a quick question. Can we just zoom out 30,000 feet? Because some of us have not been following this as closely. So your article is great, but for our listeners who haven't had time to read it just yet, when I think of hospitals in the city, I think of sort of like there's Columbia, there's NYU, there's Montefiore in the Bronx, and then there's Sinai. Can you give us just a lay of the land of like how many hospitals there are? You know, are there certain boroughs that are over or underserved? And when I think of hospital closings, I oftentimes think of like what's been going on in the South where these hospital deserts. And then it reminds me of 2013, where I think much of de Blasio's success, remember he got arrested on the front lines trying to save, what was it, King's? It wasn't King's Hospital. It was the one.
He was trying to save Long Island College Hospital, which did end up closing.
Right. So it's performance theater.
And he toured Peninsula Hospital in Rockaway and did jack shit to get another
and
hospital.
And closed, too.
Again.
But continue.
More performance theater. So, you know, he was there, but I remember we were talking about these hospital closings in 2013. Then, at least in my world, it hasn't, and, you know, on the podcast, Harry and I, and now Harry, Katie and I, we have, hospital closings aren't a thing that we talk about on a regular basis. And now it seems like here we are again. In a COVID world, I'm not going to say post-COVID, in an aging New York population of all races and classes, one would think, if anything, we would be expanding hospitals. And then can you also, I know I'm throwing a lot at you, just give us a quick overview of kind of like this tension between public and private? Like, is there, you know, federal / state funding versus are we just seeing like a cash grab from like rich, greedy hospital owners who just want to maximize profits and they really don't care if they're leaving people without services? I just think I need, like, explain this to me like I'm in first grade and haven't been paying attention to something that is very real for a lot of families. But I'm in a particular network because I have insurance that seems pretty strong. So to be totally transparent, I don't really pay attention to hospitals. I'm also not of an age where I use hospitals that often, knock on wood. But I know a lot of New Yorkers do.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to give an overview. So New York City is certainly not like a lot of other places. It's a big city with a lot of hospitals. We're in an unusual position where we have a number of major private health systems, plus we have New York City Health and Hospitals, the public system, which has, I believe, 10 hospitals throughout the boroughs. And so we do have quite a number of hospitals, but like a lot of other places in the country, New York City has seen over the last several decades a pattern of hospital consolidation. So those systems that we know now, you know, Mount Sinai, NYU Langone, New York Presbyterian, those have become larger systems over time by acquiring hospitals like Mount Sinai acquired Beth Israel in a merger with what was called Continuum Health Partners, along with a Brooklyn location back in about a decade ago now. And so those systems have gotten larger by absorbing hospitals. We've seen closures like Long Island College Hospital, and we have seen that pattern continuing even now with COVID. And one of the things that I've examined in my reporting is that a lot of times this consolidation tends to disproportionately impact lower income communities, often communities of color. We see that in New York City. That's not unique to New York City. That happens across the country. And part of it is that hospitals have a kind of aversion to empty beds or excess capacity. So we have a lot of really large hospitals, like Beth Israel is really large. It was originally 700, 800 beds. And now there's been a kind of shifting of the model where there's urgent care centers, there's standalone emergency departments like what replaced St. Vincent's in the Village. There's all of these what's called outpatient centers where you can kind of walk in or you can schedule a procedure at a doctor's office. So hospitals say, well, a lot of care is shifting kind of out of the hospital and into the community at these other settings, which also coincidentally financially do better for hospitals when they operate these outpatient centers because of a lot of different reasons with federal and state funding. And so the larger pattern has been shifting away from those large hospitals, but also there's been that consolidation where, you know, people are still going to hospitals, people still need emergency care, they're always going to need inpatient care. And so what we're seeing with the current closures is that there are real concerns that these things are going to put a lot of pressure on existing hospitals. And those are things like we saw with St. Vincent's, for example, when that closed, that was serving an indigent population. People could go there if they couldn't pay. They maybe had trouble going to other hospitals. And so when that closed in Greenwich Village in Manhattan, a lot of people shifted to, for example, Beth Israel. And so now if Beth Israel is closing, those patients are going to shift to, say, Bellevue, the public hospital that is the closest, or NYU Langone, right next door to Bellevue and Kips Bay. But those hospitals already see long wait times. There's tons of people in their ERs waiting for beds. So it can cause a real strain on the healthcare system, is the concern, especially if you're not putting in those other kinds of care options in place. And not everyone can go to every hospital. Depends who's in your insurance network, you know, for seeing a doctor. You'll be able to get emergency care anywhere. But there are a lot of real issues that come up as far as people sometimes have loyalty to their local hospital. Beth Israel serves a lot of low-income and elderly people who've been going there for decades. They know the doctors. They know the people there.
So I've got one more real big 20,000-foot question, but before we get to that, I want to talk about downtown. As you keep bringing up St. Vincent, I want to talk about downstate. in Brooklyn. I want to talk real estate. But first, can you explain a little what's going on with this public fight that Mount Sinai, which runs Beth Israel, which looks to be closing, is having with this insurer? I've had a few New Yorkers who this has impacted their coverage. What the hell was going on here? And these things generally don't become public this way.
Yeah, that's actually something that we're seeing more and more of. There was actually an analysis that was done by some experts that showed that there is more media coverage about these kinds of disputes, and also that these disputes are becoming more common in the sense that there are always kinds of these arguments behind the scenes, but now we're actually seeing ruptures between hospitals and insurance companies. And so
that about what they'll pay for different procedures and things like that.
Right, right. So you have a hospital system has a contract with an insurance company that determines what they get paid for certain procedures for the people on that insurance plan. And when we're talking about United Healthcare, biggest insurer in the US, and they've had a pattern now of breaking up with pretty large health systems. And Mount Sinai basically is just the latest in that trend. I mean, we've seen some other things like this. There was a pretty heated battle a couple years ago with Montefiore. But with Mount Sinai, one of the unusual things that happened is that they actually didn't reach an agreement. So the coverage for hospital care ended, and now coverage of doctors is basically on the verge of ending, which is an even broader impact because it's not just people who are going for those inpatient services. And it covers a huge amount of people. I think there's about 1.3 million people who are enrolled in United Healthcare plans that would be affected. It's a lot of people who get insurance through their employer. So I think that's probably why you're hearing a lot more about it now.
People are getting emails, and that's how they're learning about this.
Yeah, they're getting notices. They're supposed to get notices saying that their coverage is ending. There's supposed to be continuous coverage requirements to kind of phase things out so that it's not such an abrupt end. But, you know, we just talked about consolidation. Mount Sinai is a massive system in New York City, and so these are a lot of locations for healthcare and a lot of doctors that people are just going to lose in-network access to, meaning you can still go to those doctors, but it's going to be a lot more expensive depending on your plan. So that's really going to affect the market, and also it's probably really going to affect Mount Sinai's finances potentially.
Thank you again for coming on. Just one quick follow-up here. I just want to say, in your reporting of Politico New York, as well as in this conversation, I really appreciate the way you've taken these really complex and often hard to understand and penetrate issues and written about them and are talking about them in ways that help make some of this clear, because my head starts swimming at a certain point. I've talked with Chrissy about this with higher ed a lot. I feel like land in New York is so valuable that all these things that are nominally other things, and especially things with tax breaks, like hospital systems and universities, end up as real estate hustles with attendant businesses. Outside of that model, right, over in Brooklyn, the governor has a plan to close Downstate, which is a state hospital that's right complex that's right next to an H&H city hospital complex. Can you just speak for a minute about how real estate factors in here? You brought up St. Vincent's, which was, you know, at the center of the HIV/AIDS crisis. It's where all those patients went. It's luxury housing now, and it's because of the urgent care. And when I talk to conservatives and smart ones, they're like, look, this is just what customers want, and it's a better business model. But I just see all of this consolidation of people who can hold more and more cash, and the land here is so expensive, only the richest people can. And then things seem that New Yorkers use seem to disappear. So I just love your big picture thoughts for New Yorkers who maybe tune in and out of all this, pay more attention if they or a loved one is in a hospital, about what's happening here.
Yeah, there's been more action to try and actually have control over what happens when, say, a hospital closes. I mean, the best example that I can cite is former Governor Andrew Cuomo, initiated a big merger of three hospitals in Brooklyn right around SUNY Downstate, as it happens, which included a lot of state funding for supportive housing, basically housing complexes with services on site, on the properties of those hospitals with the consolidation. And hospitals, as I said earlier, you know, they used to be these really big buildings with a lot of beds that executives see, we don't need that many beds anymore. So you have sometimes these, not so much in New York City, depending on which borough, these, you know, big plots of land that you could say are underutilized. And so there are conversations like with SUNY Downstate of, could we put housing here? And then what kind of housing? Who gets to have that say? I mean, if it's a state hospital, right, that's them. The something like Beth Israel, it's possible the state, since they have to give regulatory approval, will try and do conditions for a closure, but that's really Mount Sinai's prerogative of what they do with that space. So there are a lot of conversations about this, and of course it is a real concern. There is also a need for housing. Housing can improve health outcomes, and access to housing can have an impact on health. So that's also part of the argument here. But it is a very real concern. And with SUNY Downstate, again, that's a state hospital, like you said, across the street from a city-run public hospital. This isn't the first time it's been talked about of closing SUNY Downstate. It's, you know, it's public. They get a lot of low-income patients that they don't get paid as much for, as far as reimbursement for services. So that can be kind of a bad cycle financially for a hospital. So then the conversation is, do we keep propping up that hospital with financial subsidies from the state, or do we think about another way to use that facility?
You know, it's interesting, Maya, because Harry and I have talked a lot about, you know, I think a lot of universities in major cities are just real estate agents that happen to teach kids on the side. Some do it better than others. And when it comes to hospital, I mean, there is a lot of space and land that's owned. Where does, you know, you mentioned before where some of these patients could still see their doctor, but just not in the same capacity, which for many people is utterly impossible, right? They wouldn't be able to afford it. So we're ostensibly saying they can't see their doctor. Where do places like CityMD and urgent care factor into this narrative? Because I know those places were very popular during COVID. I even took advantage of it during, you know, high COVID season because I didn't want to go into a hospital to get tested. And they were saying, you know, well, come to this small facility and you're in and out. If it's only just a test that you need, you know, sort of leave the hospitals for real stuff. Are those centers, which seem to still be pretty robust in a lot of neighborhoods, are they part of, I'm not going to say the problem, but the equation with some of these closures where people have just gotten accustomed to either telehealth or a CityMD system?
Yeah, for sure. And there's a couple of different ways to think about that. I mean, one is that it's creating more access. You know, a lot of what I hear from hospitals is that there are a lot of visits, especially to their emergency rooms, that are more appropriate for a quote unquote lower level of care, meaning you're coming into the emergency room, but you probably could have gone to an urgent care. Maybe you just needed like a quick swab and a prescription for antibiotics, and you didn't really need to be in an emergency room, which is more, you know, for, they want to see your stroke patients and people with heart attacks and cardiac issues and things like that. So to some extent, it is good that we have this other model, right? Because then that allows the emergency rooms to focus on those patients who really can't go anywhere else. I mean, you know, if you're having a stroke, you don't want to go to CityMD. but the problem is that they'll also, first of all, people don't necessarily know what's happening to them. You kind of have to triage yourself and think about where's the best place to go. And also, a lot of people don't trust going to whatever place. They think, you know, I'm going to go to the hospital because I know that I'm going to get seen. Under federal law, that hospital has to screen you in the emergency room and see you. And so if you don't have insurance or if you have Medicaid, you don't necessarily know or know the process of finding out if you can go to that CityMD or that urgent care center and get the services you need, and you will end up with this massive bill. There's this sense of like, well, if I go to the hospital emergency room, I know that I'll get what I need. And so I think that that's also an aspect that isn't really always considered when you think of hospital executives closing these hospitals, and they say there are these other channels. There are reasons why people don't always use those other channels. And so the urgent cares are definitely great, and we see more health systems getting into them. Mount Sinai's talked about expanding its own urgent care with this. SUNY Downstate has talked about opening an urgent care if it were to close inpatient services. Northwell Health operates urgent cares across the city. So there is more investment in those models that can be really great. But also, I mean, during COVID, we kind of saw how there are limits too. I mean, there's only so much that those providers can do before they have to refer you to someone else, like a specialist, or you have to go to the hospital.
If we could pivot from scary hospital trends and changes to how staffing issues and budget constraints at the city's health department could also be endangering the health of New Yorkers. You had a story last October about, I'll just read the lead, the understaffed agency charged with monitoring tuberculosis in New York City is struggling to respond to new cases, fueling fears of a resurgence decades after the nation got TB under control. So if you want to talk a little bit about the health department, if things in terms of the staffing has improved since October, knowing that there's been a hiring freeze, I'm going to guess that it hasn't. And just talk about how I know a lot of people became well aware, well acquainted with the health department during COVID, but what's going on with them now and how budget limitations, people leaving, staffing, hiring freezes play a role in that.
Yeah. So the good news is I have been told that they're going to be investing in staffing at those TB clinics after the attention to the issue. I'm waiting for more data on that to really confirm what's going on there. But I anecdotally can say that's the impression that I've been given by the health department on that. But it also shows, I mean, the city health department is an interesting position because they do a lot of really critical public health work, like running TB clinics where they basically take over from hospitals. Hospitals maybe will diagnose someone and do initial treatment, but then they go to the city's TB clinics. So they're actually, the hospitals aren't, that's something that they're not really doing. It's the city health department that takes over that role, which is unusual. The city health department does that for a couple of things, but is not really in the business of providing a ton of healthcare. I mean, they run sexual health clinics, and we've seen recently the expansion of getting medication abortion through the city health department, but there are real staffing issues with some of the sexual health clinics. There is one that has been closed, you know, pretty much indefinitely. So a similar issue to what we saw with the TB clinics, but it's generally the impact with staffing and with budgets is more so on those select kind of public health roles and direct care that the city health department plays. And TB is a big one. Sexual reproductive health is another big one.
So we'll close here, but, you know, and not to give away any story ideas or anything, but what are you looking ahead to? I mean, I look at the sort of the latter part of this fiscal year of the budget stuff, but do you want to give a little teaser about what you're looking into, what can, we can expect? You know, and a lot of your great coverage.
Yeah, I'm really paying close attention right now to the state budget making process that determines a ton about healthcare in New York, since mostly it's regulated at the state level. And so we'll see how much funding hospitals get, and hospitals meaning sort of these health systems. So not just the hospitals, but all of the other things that they run. If there's going to be a pot of money for SUNY Downstate, if there's going to be a pot of money for other safety net hospitals that could follow the path of Mount Sinai, Beth Israel, or SUNY Downstate in coming years. If there's going to be higher Medicaid rates for those hospitals, which lose money often caring for Medicaid patients because the reimbursement rate is lower than for, you know, like a UnitedHealthcare commercial insurance. So those are things that really impact who can access care, where they can access care, how much it costs. And so the state budget will be really big as far as what the landscape will look like the rest of the year and years to come.
Maya Kaufman, Politico New York, thank you so much for joining us and for writing your great coverage of the state of health care and everything in New York City. We appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me and glad to talk about all of this work. There's a lot going on.
FAQ.
FAQ NYC is headquartered at The City, a nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom dedicated to hard-hitting journalism that serves the people of New York. We receive support from P&T Knitwear, an independent bookstore, cafe, and event space on Manhattan's Lower East Side with a podcast studio that can be freely reserved for community use. The Pod is an affiliate of the Colin Powell School at CUNY's City College, where Christina Greer is one of the Moynihan Public Scholars inaugural fellows. And we're an affiliate of the Flaming Hydra newsletter, a collective of 60 writers and artists, including FAQ's Harry Siegel, delivering a cooperatively owned newsletter to your inbox that you'll actually want to open. See more and subscribe at flaminghydra.com. Our hosts today were Harry Siegel, Christina Greer, and Katie Honan. I'm our engineer, Adam Kimera, and Harry is our executive producer. Thanks to our guest, Maya Kaufman of Politico New York. And thank you, listener, for joining us and making it this far. Be kind, be cool, and we'll be back soon with more.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Chrissy, when you brought up Bill de Blasio, because I was with him in that tour when he was running for mayor, and he like toured the closed down, flooded Peninsula Hospital. And I'm like, then you didn't do anything.
Right. I remember he got arrested, and that was like the big thing, that a mayoral candidate's getting arrested. I mean, right. I think the piece
Sean
that
Donovan
Harry
put, got arrested, too. In that
right. Obama, Obama, Obama. My father, my father, my father. But I do think, Harry, in the chat, I mean, so many people do use emergency rooms as their regular doctor. So it's like that is also a huge part of the problem, where you just have a lot of emergency room doctors.
3 hours, 40 minutes?
Man. Yeah, that's the latest January data. I mean, you know, it depends, but people think you get seen right away in an ER and like you'll have someone triage, but like you are not getting seen right away. Like if you're having a heart attack currently and EMS knows you are and bring you in, okay, maybe. Or you're like, you know, you need trauma care. You just got shot or something, but you're waiting a long time. There's a ton of people waiting.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's interesting how the hospitals will kind of, you know, Mount Sinai put all of these stats out about like, well, like 70% of our ER visits at Beth Israel could have been seen at like a more appropriate level of care. Yeah. And it's like, well, we're not considering the reasons why they weren't. There are very real reasons why those people went to the emergency room. Not that necessarily they needed to, but they're, you know, let's think about why they did. And account for that too. And you don't really see that happening when they're closing, because you know,
right.
I do gotta run. Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Maya. We really appreciate it.
You guys rock. Thank you, Maya.
Yeah, of course.